Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman, Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Brain and Spine Center, New York Presbyterian Hospital.
And also, your podcast is This Is Your Brain with Dr. Phil Stieg. So I want to throw that in there. As a neurosurgeon, what have you seen about the impact of COVID-19 on the brain? I guess you've seen up close and personal what it's doing.
It's been fascinating. It's been an unfortunate learning process for us. We're just about actually to submit a paper looking at our institution's COVID patients, and we had over 2,500 patients managed within the New York Presbyterian system, the largest number of patients within the metropolitan area. And we found that 1.5% of the patients had what are called ischemic strokes. There are two types of strokes, one where blood vessels get plugged up, and then the other type is where you bleed into your brain. And we're talking about the one where the blood vessels get plugged up. And this 1.5% rate is 7 times higher than the average number of strokes seen in patients that have routine influences. So one of the major concerns that we as neurosurgeons deal with is the risk of stroke. Other things that you see, if you look at the Chinese experience, over 30% of the patients had specific neurologic symptoms, which included dizziness, headache, impaired levels of consciousness, gait instability, and even seizures. Everybody has heard about the peripheral nervous system effects, you know, the loss of smell, the loss of taste, some visual changes, and some pain. But, you know, as a neurosurgeon, the things we worry about most is the effect that it has on the blood vessels, resulting in either blocking them or in bleeding into the brain.
Do you usually find the flu affecting the brain, the regular old garden variety flu? Is this something new?
No. That was the point of our paper that we're going to be getting out hopefully today is, you know, in looking at routine influenza, routine flu, we've found in our population, which is a big one, that the risk of having these brain impacts or strokes, specific kind of brain impacts, stroke, is elevated over 7 times. Now, everybody with the flu has a little bit of headache, a little bit of dizziness and things like that, but not these severe things like seizures and gait instability and strokes.
Why do you think that COVID-19 is causing strokes and who's most at risk?
We found that the most strokes occur in the elderly patients with severe infections. In addition to that, the elderly patients have secondary disorders, meaning that they have diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, you know, other things like that. So it sets them up. So it's the very sick patient with other problems.
We are hearing about people with strokes and heart attacks afraid to come to the ER, and that seems to be a big problem. How would you address that? How is that going to be overcome?
What I would do is I would like to reassure your listeners that despite the fact that we were taking care of this pandemic crisis in New York City, the hospital was still open for managing medical and surgical emergencies. We did that without turning an eye. What we had to do was turn down the volume of the elective procedures. It's really unfortunate. What we have found, I had several patients during this crisis that laid around at home for about 5 days or after they had a ruptured aneurysm in their head. We've had patients coming in that have had strokes and they kind of laid around hoping it would go away. We've had patients with massive brain tumors that just hoped that they were going to get better. I would want to reassure patients that they can come to the emergency room. The hospital has made all the arrangements that we possibly can following the Department of Health guidelines and the CDC guidelines to isolate COVID positive patients from patients that we don't know whether they're positive. They don't have symptoms.
I understand there's a new hour one protocol.
Yeah, this was started, again, one of the major problems with the COVID situation is that in order to do social distancing, we also have to limit the number of family members that can come in with a patient. With that, the patient becomes isolated, and sometimes it makes communication difficult. In addition to that, some patients would come in and they would be completely lucid, and in a short period of time, they would deteriorate cognitively and intellectually. So unfortunately, we had to start this program where we would start talking with the patient about their wishes, what they wanted in case things really went badly, because, again, the family couldn't be there, and it made it difficult to communicate with the family. So we initiated with our palliative group. Actually, they initiated it. this process where patients would be met in the emergency room, and in a gentle way, in a kind, compassionate way, we had to speak with them about the what if. Yeah. What if something goes bad? How do you want us to handle this?
How do you calm somebody down? I guess some people would say, okay, this is what you need to do, and others might freak out.
Absolutely. And there's a wide spectrum of how a patient is going to respond. And we as caregivers just have to recognize that. And each individual, if they get angry or extremely scared, we just have to give them time to work through that emotional process and hopefully get to where we need to go. And in addition to that, we hope that we don't have to go there, meaning that we hope that they're COVID infection doesn't lead to deterioration, and this does end up being just a conversation.
There's a lot of fear out there, as we just were talking about, and also misinformation. What would you want our listeners to know about COVID-19?
Again, it's a communicable disease. So what's being said by our governor every day is reasonable and rational. I think that there's a lot of anxiety out there on the part of a number of individuals. Mm-hmm. So rational things, commonsensical things should be done. Social distancing, wearing a mask, wearing rubber gloves. I think that and we're seeing it now, the curve is going down. As the curve goes down, we're going to progressively see reduction in the restrictions that are placed upon us. There's the whole emotional thing that goes on between the economy and the disease. I can't comment on that, but the emotional well-being of our patients and also our healthcare providers is extremely important to us. Within the institution, our Department of Psychiatry has been on 24-hour call to help our professional staff cope with the stress, but they're also on call, obviously, to help any patient and or a patient's family that may be having difficulty with this. I would like to reassure patients that one of the senses once you come into a hospital and you're isolated from your family is you feel like you've lost control. To a degree with any disease, we've lost control. We try to help the individual feel enabled. We will communicate. I've had a number of FaceTime visits on a patient's cell phone with their loved ones. So we talk together and make sure that everybody is on the same page. They won't be forgotten. And the other thing that they really worry about is they worry about suffering. And obviously that is something that we're extremely attentive to in making sure that that does not happen.
How can we protect our brains so that we have a good chance of surviving all of this?
Yeah. Well, if you get it now and you haven't taken care of your brain, unfortunately, it's too late. That's the purpose of my podcast, This Is Your Brain. It teaches you how to take care of your brain so that when things like this occur, you're somewhat ready for it. So the commonsensical, assertive things that a patient or anybody can do is a heart-healthy, brain-healthy lifestyle, which means you get regular sleep, regular social interaction, now 6 feet apart with face masks and gloves. You can look up either an American Heart Association Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, the MIND diet. Those are all very appropriate variations of the Mediterranean diet. Regular exercise is important, and certainly getting 7 hours of sleep at night is a good thing. And then other things that you can do is the meditation and yoga and things like that. Physical exercise is important. You know, getting your heart rate up for 30 minutes throughout the day. Now, I don't really advocate, as you know, for the elderly patient, I don't advocate going out and pounding on the pavement and running, because that has secondary impacts on your disc spaces in your spine, and then you start complaining of low back pain and joint pain. But certainly getting out for a power walk, working on a stationary bicycle or an ergonomic machine or Stairmaster, i.e. low impact kinds of things. And not doing 300-pound snatch and jerks, but doing low weights with lots of repetitions or with bands. And certainly as we age, lots of stretching in order to maintain balance. And doing balancing exercises is extremely important.
I think people are actually going, or some people anyway, will actually listen during this time of isolating at home.
I'm hopeful. I mean, I think that, let's face it, we all have more time to reflect, more time to read, more time to be with our families. There are some, in this day and age now, with all this social media going on, I've seen some really good little excerpts about what life used to be and how we've gone back to that. And I am hopeful that people are attentive to that, that we can try to, in New York, that's difficult to do, I think, you know, staying away from the hustle and bustle. But I'm hopeful that people are more attentive to their personal needs.
Anything else you want to add? You were fantastic as always.
I hope that we've gotten the message across about what to do long term, and I hope that we've alleviated fears for people that are listening to this, that yes, it's a serious disease, but I guess the one thing that we would remember is every day in the news we see that they're talking about the number of deaths, 25,000 deaths, but the mortality rate, since we don't really know what the number of infected people is, the mortality rate, i.e. dying from this, is really quite low. It's around 1%. You know, so we have to keep that in perspective in terms of thinking about all the other things that actually cause mortality in our society as well.
Well, thank you so much.
Pat, thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Stay safe.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.